KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19. Live from the Jefferson County Courthouse, this is KPTZ, Port Townsend.
Knowing, especially given the uncertainty we have now about immunity, are we just going to have to let the virus move through in a very controlled way? And the hammer and the dance talks about the hammer being much stricter social restrictions that, you know, as soon as we start, when we ease, so the hammer is putting those in place. And then when it seems like we can ease up, we go back to the dance and we allow a little more activity and a little more exposure. And then as soon as that starts, you know, reaching a certain threshold, then you go back to the hammer, and that you might have to do that a number of times. You know, if it's allowed, say, 10% of the population to be exposed at a time, that might be, you know, 10 of those cycles that we have to go through. So just, you know, I think we have to be realistic that we are not going to be able to be in lockdown forever and stop the virus 100%, even if we have looks like been able to do that with some success in Jefferson County. We know that that's not going to work on a lot of levels. So, you know, really curious about how this dial, turning the dial a little bit works, knowing that it's not going to be the light switch.
Right. And the challenge with that as well, though, Kate, is if you're a business and you reopen and you stock up and then you have to dial back again, how many times can you go through, really opening and then sort of quasi-shutting and going back to delivery only or something like that and financially survive? So.
I'll tell you, they eat that one time. I mean, honestly, you know, unless it's part of the plan, it's a huge operation to stop, especially if you have, you know, stock that has a shelf life, you know. I mean, yeah, that's something that's we're going to have to be really careful with, and it's going to be tough. It's going to be a dance, you know, and hopefully we can also, you know, increase our basic hygiene so the community, this lower community mitigations have more effect. I see it is 9:46 now, so we'd like to welcome listeners from KPTZ as we're for our weekly update from Dr. Locke and our emergency operations, the Department of Emergency Management manager, Willie Bent. Hello, Willie. Looking good. And I think Dr. Locke is with us. So before you start, Dr. Locke, we've got a slight abbreviated schedule today because we do have a public hearing scheduled for 10:15. We don't have to hit it right at 10:15, but we'll cut everyone off a little earlier than we normally do. With that, Dr. Locke, are you with us? Would you give us an update?
Yes. Can you see me? There we go.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I'll try to move through this quickly and hopefully answer as many questions from that earlier discussion that I was listening to. So first, quickly with the numbers, we're now nearing a million cases in the United States. We're at 987,000, and the death toll is over 55,000, which would be a case fatality rate right around 5%. And I'll explain that a little bit more in a moment. Here in Washington State, where our total confirmed cases is 13,521, and with that, 749 deaths. So that's 5.5% case fatality rate. And whereas Washington was the place where this all started in the U.S., we're now our cases are about 1.3% of the U.S. cases. And we're about 2% of the U.S. population. So this is now spread all over the country. We are no longer the epicenter of coronavirus in any sense. In Jefferson County, we have been holding stable at the same case count now for over 2 weeks. So the confirmed cases are 28, and that has not changed over 2 weeks. We've had no deaths, fortunately. And if people look on our website, will notice a new statistic we're using. And this was because people kept asking this over and over again is, who is recovered? And that's actually a hard question to answer with certainty in a new infection like this. But we did adopt a case-wide state definition for recovered, and that's what we're using on our website. So of the 28 confirmed cases in Jefferson County, we consider 24 of them to be recovered. And what recovered means is that it's been over a month, it's been over 28 days, and you're no longer hospitalized, and you're alive. So those are basically the definitions of recovered. So we know the case fatality rate, that is the number of deaths per confirmed cases, but what we really want to know is what's known as the infection fatality rate. So of all the people infected, how many people succumb to that? We know it's a much lower number than the case fatality rate, and we're now starting to get these serology studies back from population centers that are giving us an idea of how widespread the infection is. The one that is shockingly high is from New York City, where there's serologic evidence that up to 21% of people in New York City proper were infected with this during the first surge. In California, it doesn't look near as high. Their numbers are running between 2.5% and 4%. We're going to actually have some Washington state data that will be published this week that will probably be in a similar range, about 2.5% to 3%. And we think that's likely the national number. So based on that, the infection fatality rate is more like 0.5.
Unmuted.
I do
muted
soundtrack.
I thought you would have chosen. All right.
So the infection fatality rate is now looking to be between 0.5%, that is 5 in 1,000, and 9 in 1,000. And that's 5 to 9 times more lethal than influenza for comparison. Here in Washington State, epidemiologically, the curve has definitely flattened, and it's starting to drop, but dropping very slowly. So it's not a symmetrical looking curve. It went up rapidly, but now it's dropping very slowly. And we still have 200 to 300 new cases of coronavirus that are being diagnosed here in Washington State every day. We also have some new understanding of this that's emerging to try to explain some of these patterns, these intense outbreaks in cities and much less intense activity in rural areas. And we think that's very much a characteristic of this infection, that the intensity of the spread and the severity of the illness is really related strongly to population density. So with population density comes crowding and more contaminated surfaces and closed rooms with poor ventilation, all these circumstances that promote pre-symptomatic shedding, which we know is a big deal. That is, people who are infected shed it several days before they know they're infected, and maybe asymptomatic shedding, which is something we understand much less. But we're learning more and more about in these cruise ship studies and the studies on the aircraft carrier Theodore Roosevelt. These things are telling us that asymptomatic shedding is a bigger deal than we previously thought. We also are accumulating evidence that the amount of exposure you have, that is how much virus you're exposed to, is a strong predictor of severity of illness. And we know this from some very tragic data, that the first healthcare workers who were exposed to this in hospitals before they even knew a pandemic was going on, there was not only a very high rate of infection, but very severe disease, including a high fatality rate in otherwise healthy young nurses and doctors and other health workers. And we think this is because if you have a very large exposure, and especially an airborne exposure, this disease is much more dangerous than if you have very low-grade exposures. And this is something that's informing our planning for this, and that it's critically important that we avoid these high-dose exposures in dense, crowded situations. Right now, we know the highest risk areas are workplaces where there's people work very closely together, like meat packing plants, like migrant farm worker housing is of high concern. We've already learned that long-term care facilities are a very high-risk area. Jails and prisons are as well. So we're focusing a lot of our attention on those kind of areas as we move forward. And very much in this last week and the week and the weeks ahead, our focus in public health is on what our Secretary of Health, John Weisman, called yesterday in our weekend call, the return to public life. You know, we know that's the goal. We know we need to get back to that as soon as possible. And we know that the first steps are opening businesses where the risk of transmission is the lowest. So things like construction, including residential construction, where it's a lot of outdoor activity and people can separate. We know that as we do these things, we have to preserve the social distancing, the infection control things that we've learned work. You know, in the hammer and the dance analogy, we know conclusively now that the hammer works, and we have to find out how we can use the lightest application of that hammer, in order to maintain those benefits. And we think a lot of it has to do with the distancing factor. And so that's going to go into the design as we as we re-engineer our workplaces and our public places to reduce the risk of transmission. We're also dramatically expanding testing, and that's finally kicking in Washington State. We now are up to the point where we can do 20,000 tests a day in Washington State. That's our lab capacity. It's predicted that within 2 weeks, we'll be up to 30,000 tests a day. And that's kind of getting close to what we need. You know, that would be 100 tests a day or more in Jefferson County, which is a good capacity to have. We're still wrestling with this perverse shortage of specimen collection kits. You know, these 2 cent Dacron swabs that are still in critically short supply. But even that's improving. And so the barriers to testing are disappearing week by week, and with it, our criteria are expanding significantly, where the CDC has adopted a new set of symptoms to look for with coronavirus, and we're using those same ones here in Washington State. So a couple of weeks ago, we were telling people that suspect coronavirus is when you have a fever and a cough and shortness of breath, and now we're adding to that chills and this kind of shaking reaction with chills called rigor, muscle pain, headaches, sore throat, and this a very peculiar new loss of the sense of taste or smell. All of these are things that we're associating with coronavirus, and we want to be testing people who have these kind of symptoms. This is our new target group for testing.
Dr. Locke, can I interrupt?
Yeah, with you? Yeah, please.
So with these new criteria for testing, I assume we're talking antigen testing still. I just love for you to talk. What are the thresholds that to get tested at this point? I mean, when we're at 100 tests a day in Jefferson County, is anybody that, you know, showing any symptoms will be able to get tested? Is that basically?
Yeah, that's it exactly. Is that we want anyone with any sign of infectious disease that's consistent with coronavirus. So fever is the strongest indicator that some things cross over. You know, sneezing, coughing can be caused by a lot of different things. Allergies, most notably, sometimes just, you know, respiratory irritants. But fever with any of those other symptoms, and sometimes not even fever. Also, exposure risk is really important. So as we diagnose more cases, we'll also identify their contacts. And if you're a contact of a known case, at any sign of illness, we will want to test you. So this increased testing and discovering cases as they occur is going to be critically linked to this opening back up of society. Because we know that as we do more tests, we'll find more cases. Also, as we open up society, more cases will occur because of that increased contact with people. And our strategy to manage this depends heavily on our ability to not only test a lot of people, but then when we find positive cases, to very quickly do case investigations, identify all contacts, and then get those cases and contacts into a kind of a medical management system where we're closely following them. We're making sure that they're staying home, they're staying in isolation or quarantine, but we're also supporting them through this process. Because it's important to realize in this first wave, I think we did a very good job of this here in Jefferson County, where we had fairly low case numbers and a real excellent team that was very experienced in doing this. But in places like King County and Snohomish County, they were absolutely overwhelmed. They were barely able to call all cases, do a quick phone interview, mail them some stuff to send to their contacts, and that was it. And we have to do way, way better than that in this next wave. So we have to thoroughly investigate every case, get them linked up to the healthcare system that can manage them, that can check in with them every day and see how they're doing. And if they develop complications, to treat those and to hospitalize them when necessary and all of that. And we need to do a similar thing with people who are in quarantine, who are not ill, but we have to monitor very carefully for the earliest signs of illness. And this is going to require a very new, very well integrated partnership between public health and the healthcare system. And we've been working on that. We've been meeting with Jefferson Healthcare, and we're fortunate to have an excellent partner in Jefferson Healthcare who wants to do this and I think is very skilled at medical case management. So we're rapidly bringing that system together. And I want to emphasize that it's going to be more than just public health and the medical system. This is really going to take a community response because there's been an unfortunate tendency to look at people with this infection or people who have been quarantined as somehow threats to the community and people to be avoided or to be feared. And we have to change that attitude that we have to, you know, these are sick members of our community that are going to get better with care, 99%+ are going to survive and recover and likely become immune. And those in quarantine, most will never get infected. They'll just spend 14 days of their life in isolation. And they're really doing this for the good of the community. And we need to respect that. We need to appreciate it. I've been thinking of this as we want to adopt the golden rule of isolation and quarantine, where we treat others as we would like to be treated if we were in their situation, which is something that is a significant possibility for all of us, that if we do not become infected, we may at least become a contact. And it involves no fault on the part of anyone. It's the random movement of this virus in the population. So we really need to build that attitude where we have concern and support and even gratitude for those who are sacrificing their liberty for the sake of others. So I heard some questions on the serology testing, and yes, that's very unsettled right now. There's been an explosion of tests, now over 100 different manufacturers. We know that these portable point-of-care tests are the lowest quality. Most of them are worse than worthless. And I say that because they generate a lot of false positives. That is to say, they tell people they're immune when they really aren't. And that's dangerous information because it encourages you to take risks that could have dire consequences. False negatives are not desirable, but they're less harmful. You know, if you're immune and it just tells you you're not, at least it's not going to encourage high-risk behavior. We do have some lab testing that is much more accurate, and this is a technological thing. Eventually, the tests will become both more sensitive and specific, and right now they're very valuable for looking at populations and seeing what the how many people have been infected who didn't know about it. They're also useful in some clinical situations where we have people where we wonder if they had COVID-19, but they didn't have the antigen test, so we can do serologic testing in the aftermath of their infection and get more information. But what we're encouraging people not to use them for is some kind of guarantee of immunity, because we just don't know how that works yet. That we know a bit from SARS coronavirus. We know that immunity tended to persist for 1 to 3 years after a SARS infection. So there was immunity at least for that long. What we don't know is sometimes antibodies will disappear in a person's bloodstream, but they remain immune. That is to say, when they're re-exposed, their body remembers the infection and starts to produce antibodies again. But it'll be a long time before we know whether that applies with this particular infection. But I'm encouraged. I think in all likelihood, this measurable antibody levels does mean that there's some immunity. And the reason I think this is that the infections like hepatitis C or HIV infection, where people develop antibodies, but they don't get immune from the infection. In those cases, the virus persists in your symptom or in your system. And what we know with COVID is that most people get rid of the virus. Almost all get rid of it eventually. So the antibodies seem to clean the virus out of our systems, and that's sort of a good sign for long-term immunity. So I'll summarize. And wrap up just by saying, you know, the next big push that's coming is in increased testing, you know, and we're already ramping up testing this week. And each week, I think we'll be able to do more and more. But we need to combine this with state-of-the-art case investigation and contact tracing. And we're fortunate to have a very good team to do this in Jefferson County. We have 7 very well-trained members. We're going to add 2 more to our core team. We can ramp that up and add even more as we need to. And the goal of all of this is this return to public life. And we think that as we do this, the way the hammer and the dance will play out, the dance will be in these sort of 2-week segments. So we can open things up and we can carefully observe the effects over 2-week periods, and then potentially ramp things up a bit more and step by step by step. And we think that this is really going to start in mid-May is what sort of the word we're getting from the governor's office. But it's critically important that we have this testing and intensive case management and contact tracing in place before we do that. So we're working on deadlines to get that done.
Dr. Locke, on that, just a quick question. I mean, you talk about the capacity for 100 tests for Jefferson County. So say 25 tests a day are positive. What kind of contact tracing team would you need to be able to manage that kind of load?
That would be a very high load to manage. I think we could actually do it with our current team. But we do have a backstop. So the state has been also developing this capability. They hope to bring somewhere between 700 and 900 investigators online. They're using the National Guard. They're using people from the Department of Licensing and volunteers and other people within the Department of Health. And for some counties, they're going to do all the case investigation and contact tracing for some counties. We chose not to go that direction because we think we can do a much better job. We think this kind of personal approach, you know, if we approach people personally, if we engage them with the local medical system, that will yield better outcomes. Because, you know, there's a term that's being used that, you know, what this system has to have is what they're calling low leakage. You know, we can't afford to miss cases that are out there. We can't afford to not find contacts. Every case we miss is going to drive transmission. And the better we are at this, the less transmission we're going to see. So that's kind of the brutal reality of it. I'd be very surprised if we saw that high a level of cases, 25 a day. But we'll only know when we get there.
Thank you, Dr. Locke. Any other questions for Dr. Locke this morning?
No, I know we have limited time, so hold mine.
Okay, we might have a minute more. We've got Mark McCauley ready for the hearing there, but we'll pass it off to Willie Bintz for an update from the Department of Emergency Management and the EOC.
Yeah, so and I'll keep this as quick as I possibly can. A couple of weeks ago, I had mentioned we were starting to see some personal protective equipment made available by the State Emergency Operations Center. I'm disappointed to report that since slowed to a trickle. We kind of saw an initial surge there. Built a little bit of false confidence, and now we've seen that start to kind of dry up. So we're continuing to work with them, trying to continue to work with private vendors because, you know, as Dr. Locke talks about all this increased testing, as well as reopening of certain segments of the economy, there's going to be a lot of personal protective equipment that's going to be required to do so safely and to continue to protect a lot of our essential workers. So we're keeping an eye on that, trying to continue to get stuff in. Obviously, with healthcare workers, EMS as our first priority, but we're really trying to look long term for everyone who is potentially going to need that. We're also working, just in regards to what Dr. Locke was talking about, supporting those folks in isolation and quarantine. Working with NPREP, our neighborhood preparedness groups, to start devising plans on how we can support those individuals in isolation and quarantine at home. Again, through food delivery, through check-ins, all that kind of fun stuff. Also within our planning section, we've stood up an advanced planning team to start looking, again, down the road at these kind of continuous waves that might be coming in these, kind of two-week cycles Dr. Locke also talked about. And they're also looking at some of the conditions the State Emergency Operations Center put forward on what's called, modifying non-pharmaceutical interventions, which basically means relaxing social distancing. So they're looking at some of the conditions here in Jefferson County, kind of do an internal assessment of where we are and what those modifications to those non-pharmaceutical interventions, NPIs, might look like. Obviously, we're going to want to stay in lockstep with the state, but it'll provide us at least kind of an internal self-assessment of where we're at and how we're doing and how we're managing to flatten the curve. But other than that, again, no new cases here in a little while. So we've been mostly working on down the road planning, less in response mode, which has been very welcome. But yeah, end of report from me.
Great. Thank you very much, Willie. Any questions for Willie? All right. We appreciate your time, Dr. Locke, Willie Bentz. We'll see you next week. Sorry, because we've got lots of questions that we'll just have to ask you next week. So thank you very much for being here. And for our listening audience at home, we're going to go into a hearing on first quarter budget appropriations. We're joined by Central Services Director, Mark McCauley, as well as I'm glad to see the Wazoo Extension Director, Cliff Moore. I was quite dismayed seeing.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of County Commissioners meeting at the courthouse. Recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. And thank you for listening.